I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. With technology, you can now have an appointment with your doctor remotely. But Congress is debating whether Medicare will continue to cover the cost of those telehealth visits. So John Maffey, a physician and associate professor at UCLA, wants to make sure policymakers consider all the benefits telehealth can provide. He says it increases access to care, especially for frail, elderly, and lower-income patients who may have a harder time getting to an in-person visit.
Telehealth or audio-only phone calls have been a lifeline for some of these more vulnerable groups of patients.
And Maffey says there's another less recognized benefit: reduced carbon emissions due to fewer car trips to the doctor. In a recent study, his team found that if patients in the U.S. keep using telemedicine at the same rates they did in 2023, it would be comparable to taking at least 60,000 gas cars off the road.
This is not only boosting access to care. Telehealth may be a means to at least modestly reduce the carbon footprint of U.S. healthcare delivery.
Maffey says climate change is a major health threat, so it's important for his industry to do what it can to reduce its climate impact. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Underrepresented music, local voices, and real people. You keep CJSF independent.
From the Netherlands, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, amidst the death and destruction Israel, USA has wrought in its genocidal war on Gaza, infectious disease now plagues the besieged enclave. Infections no drugs can treat. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Israel's genocidal war on Gaza drags on. 61,000 have been killed by U.S. bombs and missiles. Indirect deaths from infectious disease, chronic diseases that can no longer be treated, and malnutrition may bring that number to 200,000. 152,000 injured. Israel's wanton destruction of Gaza's healthcare system, infrastructure, and personnel has given rise to a new term, meticide. The most recent figures from the World Health Organization, half of the 36 hospitals operating in Gaza before October 7, 2023, have been destroyed. The other half are partially functional and overwhelmed with the injured and refugees. Two-thirds of the tiny enclave's primary healthcare facilities have been demolished. In North Gaza, home to an estimated million souls at this moment, people Israel wants to forcibly expel, one partially functional hospital remains, one for about a million people. As if the situation in Gaza weren't sufficiently apocalyptic, 2 years into a war widely described as genocidal by people who know what genocide is and have the honesty to use the word, Gaza is now swept by infectious bacteria that few, if any, drugs can treat. With me to talk about all this, Bilal Irfan. Irfan is a bioethicist at Harvard Medical School and a researcher at the medical school's Brigham and Women's Hospital, specializing in conflict health. Irfan has been collaborating with Palestinian medical students and physicians in East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza in the documentation of Israeli meticide. Last week, Irfan and two colleagues published a piece in the British medical journal The Lancet entitled "Multi-Drug-Resistant Bacteria Amid Health System Collapse." Hello, Bilal Irfan. Thank you for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Bilal, this title of your comment, it's called in The Lancet, it's called a comment. together with your two colleagues, it really says it all. Multi-drug resistant bacteria amid health system collapse in Gaza. So what's the connection between these two? Health system collapse makes it harder to treat multi-drug resistant bacteria, but the presence of multi-drug resistant bacteria kind of accelerate the collapse. Can you talk about the connection between the drug-resistant bugs and the health system collapse?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was somewhat of an intentional title in that sense. And one is to paint the picture, right, that we know that multi-drug-resistant bacteria is unfortunately an issue in many low- and middle-income countries, and it's not unique to the, Gaza by any means. But what is, I guess, unique about it in this circumstance is the level of the collapse of the health system, right? And so what we try to do, at least in the piece, is talk about also the effects of the blockade and whatnot that are obviously impacting the proliferation of these infectious diseases, because there's only a few amount of drugs that are ever allowed in. Sometimes you have limited stocks of, for example, vancomycin that are coming in, or those that have been, and whatever is still existing in Gaza has been severely depleted. So in that context, one should not be surprised. And when we say collapse, what's really important to understand is we're not just talking about the collapse of institutions and networks. We're also talking about the physical collapse of hospitals, as you spoke to. And what does that really entail, right? There's families that are crowding and overcrowded in the shelters around many of these hospitals, displaced families, people who have been displaced multiple times over. So even, for example, at the Al-Ahli Arab Hospital, which was the first hospital, or at least one of the first hospitals that was struck back in October of 2023, this data that was collected was from that very hospital, which obviously has been attacked even again in April 2025. And as of, I believe, yesterday, was attacked again. And I believe seven or so people were killed in the grounds around that hospital. So obviously, we're seeing continuous attacks in these hospitals. And so when you have these attacks, people are coming in with trauma-related wounds, which, again, this sample also had such a high proportion of. I think 76% or so came from trauma or crush-related injuries in this sample. When you have people coming in with those sorts of wounds, and you don't have the sterilization procedures, you don't have the sort of protocols that are necessary, again, due to overcrowding and due to lack of hygiene. There's no clean water in Gaza. There's no proper toilets. I mean, estimates from very early into the genocide were estimating 500 to 1,000 people for one toilet in Gaza, especially in some of the refugee camps. And it's really hard to even make an estimate of what that number looks like, what that figure looks like at this point. So in that context, infectious disease is super widespread. And with a blockade and a punitive blockade that continues to restrict basic and essential medical supplies and everything from chocolates to anesthetics, it should come really as no surprise that antibiotics are being blockaded. And even the antibiotics that do make it in, or that were present in Gaza before, are not going to be effective at treating such a large population and caseload, right? So, I mean, if you look at the WHO's estimates, there's hundreds of thousands of people who are reported to have different sorts of infectious diseases. So in that context, honestly, it's sort of a blessing in a way, almost, that multi-drug resistant bacteria is not as prevalent, and it's only considered to be in two-thirds of the sample did we find it to be. But again, I say this with caution because the sample size is limited. It's only about 1,300 or so cases from one hospital. That's really important to note. One hospital in the Gaza governorate. So it doesn't capture North Gaza. It doesn't capture Deir al-Balah. It doesn't capture Khan Yunis. It doesn't capture Rafah. It only captures the people who were displaced in that area, who are arriving into that hospital, and who also had the fortunate ability to make it to the hospital to be tested upon. So that's another really important point to keep in mind, is a lot of people are succumbing to their injuries, to disease and death in the tents, languishing over there and getting buried right then and there before making it to a hospital. So they're not going to be recorded in the sort of sample. They may have had really virulent infections that different drugs would not have been able to treat. So that's really important to keep in mind when we're discussing these numbers and whatnot. It's really hard to ever paint a fully accurate picture of what's going on in Gaza.
And what you say at the start of your comment in The Lancet is, during this time, one of Gaza's only functioning microbiology services has been a small laboratory at Al-Ahli Arab Hospital. So there's just one small microbiology unit in Gaza.
So, you know, the I'm really glad you brought this up, because one aspect that I think that we keep forgetting is testing is difficult too, right? Because hospitals are being destroyed. So the laboratories that would be in hospitals may have been deliberately destroyed by Israel. Universities that may have had the sort of laboratories or the environment to do this sort of testing may have also been destroyed. We know there's so many videos of universities being blown up by the Israeli military. In a sense, it's even hard to know what is available all across Gaza, because things also change. That's another thing. A lot of Palestinians, through really efforts that are really hard for us on the outside to even imagine and grasp our heads around, have been rebuilding the sort of structures that are needed to continue providing health services. So, for example, the Al-Shifa Hospital, which is near to the Al-Ahli Arab Baptist Hospital, it reopened its emergency department after, obviously, the attacks ended in the fall of 2023. Then it was raided in March, April of 2024. And after that, deliberate destruction, burning, killing of hundreds of healthcare workers and whatnot, or at least people who were present in the hospital and patients and whatnot. After that, you had the emergency department of that hospital reopen in, I believe, September or August of 2024. And since then, it's kind of resumed its service and obviously been attacked. It's hard to really know, but it is very limited. To the best of our knowledge, we haven't seen any other data come out about this. There's also internally to Gaza, there's also blockades of different, I guess, portions, right? Part of the Israeli strategy is kind of coalescing people into concentration camps. And so we've seen people kind of being pushed from the north into the south, and then from Rafah back into kind of the middle areas of Khan Yunis and Deir al-Bala, and then kind of to the coast. And right now we're seeing the Israeli siege around Gaza City once again. And so with this, there's also been, you know, the very infamous corridor that locks the north and the south. And so it's really hard to sometimes even know from people on one side. They don't maybe have a really good health assessment of what's going on the other side. And obviously the WHO's convoys and UN agencies' operations are also limited in different parts of Gaza, depending on Israeli restrictions in a given week. So it's all in flux. So it's a nightmare to even navigate, or really a labyrinth.
Bilal, full disclosure, I have taught microbiology in the past, as I've told you, undergraduate microbiology courses over the years. So I know a little bit about this, and I know these bugs, which I think people need to know their names. And I think a lot of people have a kind of a passing knowledge of these names. Pseudomonas aeruginosa, Staphylococcus aureus, like methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, Klebsiella, a notorious drug-resistant bug, Escherichia coli. These are the bacteria that, in your limited study, you've established there's widespread presence of extended-spectrum beta-lactamase-based resistance, and that some of these bugs, like 16%, of Pseudomonas samples were colistin resistant. I mean, colistin is the antibiotic of a last resort. If a bug is resistant to colistin, you don't have anything to get it with. There's no bullet. Comment on this, but I guess what people want to know is, what does it mean if you've got a grievous wound and it becomes infected with one of these drug-resistant bacteria? And you've also said in your paper that there's a lot of polymicrobial wounds. So you've got wounds where you've got several of these drug-resistant bugs in there. It's a nightmare. How do you treat such things? And what's the outcome for a person who's has a wound and there's no way to clean it and it's infected?
Yeah, I mean, if I just kind of walk you through how it's going to look like in a hospital setting. Someone might be coming in from let's just assume there's an airstrike in a specific neighborhood. And first, it's going to take time for first responders to come, because so many ambulances are unavailable. They've been destroyed. Emergency responders have been killed, as we remember that very famous case in March, April of 2025. So in that context, with super limited ambulances, telecommunications network are also completely blacked out here and there, and then they come back on, then they get blacked out. Wi-Fi is very limited. So it can take quite a bit of time for first responders to arrive to a scene of an airstrike. And again, Israel may, as it has repeatedly done, airstrike the first responders that are coming to respond or the people who are coming in. And many times it has a strategy of doing a double or triple airstrike in a specific area to kind of clean up, as they call it, any survivors. So in that context, if someone has survived all of this and has been alive to make it to a hospital, again, assuming that there's, again, no, and we have to also understand that there's so much destruction also just in the roads, right? So even accessing, getting to a hospital, getting through that rubble to a hospital, it can be difficult. And now once they make it to a hospital, there's overcrowding, there's bed capacity is super limited. So they're competing for space. Patients are competing for space to get into a hospital bed or even to be kind of assessed clinically on the ground. And now if there's a surgeon available, many orthopedic surgeons have been killed in Gaza. We know some of the very famous ones, they've been killed or they've been abducted, tortured. And I mean, we know the testimonies that have emerged from these really Palestinian hostages that are being held by Israel. So with a limited capacity of orthopedic surgeons, with a limited capacity of anesthesiologists, with a limited capacity of all of these things, I mean, this is just getting into the human personnel to begin with, a patient is arriving. Now, when they arrive and one is trying to perform a surgery, first you need anesthesia. There's not that much anesthesia available in Gaza. And we published a paper about anesthesia just a few months ago. And I mean, anesthesia is very limited, and Palestinians have developed novel techniques to kind of try to combat this the shortage of anesthesia. But again, everything is a temporary bandage in the middle of a genocide. And so assuming the surgery is successful, there's already been studies published about fracture-related infections that are coming in from Gaza. I was even the co-author on one of these studies.
I mean, these are surgical theaters where they don't have the capacity to maintain them in a clean fashion.
Sterility is just...
There are flies all over the place.
Oh, yes.
I mean, rats, I suppose.
In some cases, yes. And obviously, I mean, we don't want to discredit the attempts of Palestinian healthcare workers who have tried to maintain a clean environment. But obviously, there's some things that are out of your control. There's sometimes not clean running water. There's limited fuel. ACs are not running in some of these hospitals. I mean, can you just imagine the scorching heat if we just take the heat? And obviously with that, there's people dying and sometimes where their wounds are infested with maggots on the hospital floor. So obviously there's...
I can't imagine this. I mean, I can imagine that it, but the thought of the vision of maggots coming out of an infected wound.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen videos of this. So it's.
And so physicians, surgeons are working on patients, and there's no to establish and maintain a clean, sterile field is really challenging.
Absolutely. And so now, if they've been treated, and, you know, I mean, some estimates that I remember from some international medical teams that went to Gaza, I mean, they came back and provided estimates of up to 80% post-surgical infections that they documented. And other studies published it at somewhere around 30, 40%. But regardless of whatever the number is, it's high, right? Even 30% is a pretty high number of people that are going to be getting that. If we even just extrapolate that to this study, that would be such a huge number of patients.
And most of these infections are drug resistant.
Oh, yes, from what we know, right? And so in that context, I mean, the prognosis, you know, in many cases, a lot of times when Palestinian healthcare workers that I've been talking to, and they're saying that the decision really comes down to is the assessment sometimes of the clinicians over there with their limited resources is, can this person survive? Because the question of survive, it's hard to, especially where we have resilient healthcare systems or relatively resilient healthcare systems in the US and Canada and Europe. Many times it's a first come first type of system in triage, at least to some extent. And many times in Gaza, I mean, they're having to make a decision, not just about, will this person survive this surgery right now? But if we use these resources to, whether it's the drugs, whether it's the anesthesia, whether it's the equipment, or even the human time and personnel in that specific moment to dedicate towards this patient, is this patient going to live 1 week from now? Is their neighborhood in one of the red zones? Do they have any surviving family members? If they have multiple amputations, these are unfortunately ethical issues and ethical dilemmas that Palestinian healthcare workers are having to make every day about, I mean, who gets to live and who gets to die at a scale that's so unimaginable for us.
Now, if a physician establishes a patient has a wound and it's infected and they want to administer an antibiotic that they've got, the correct procedure is to to take a sample of the wound and culture it on agar using, you know, little discs impregnated with antibiotic, the Kirby Bauer test, to establish which is the most efficacious antibiotic, and then administer that rather than a broad spectrum antibiotic that's going to promote resistance. But I want to ask you, this one microbiology clinic that's left, I think it's still left. Is it still there at El Ali Hospital, the microbiology clinic?
You know, I don't have a perfect answer to that.
And because my question is, physicians who would want to proceed in this fashion, are Petri plates and Nutrien agar and Kirby Bauer discs permitted into Gaza? Are the Israelis allowing these things to come into Gaza?
This is so incredibly limited, and we don't, it's really hard to say, do the Israelis allow this or that, because it can, unfortunately, in many ways, and I'm sure since you've been to the West Bank, you know this, at least the way that many soldiers operate is, many times it's going to come to that soldier's mood in a given moment, in a given second. So whether that's harassing someone or harassing an international medical physician who's bringing in something, whether that's this sort of discs, whether that's sort of surgical equipment, whether that's drugs, I mean, it's sometimes there's policies that COGAT or the Israeli military kind of postulates. It enforces them at different times. It changes its policies so rapidly. It's hard to keep up, right? We know their denial rates are so high. The WHO actually just calculated, I think, a very high denial rate, just even from March to May 2025. I think it was somewhere above 40%. So in that context, it's hard to say what is allowed in and what's not allowed in. We know sometimes chocolate's not allowed in. So we know sometimes toys are not allowed in because of their quote-unquote dual-use purpose. But I think more and more what we're also seeing, and I think if we think about any of this in the wider political context, is the masks are off. I mean, if you kind of see in the last few months, Israel hardly even attempts to come up with its Hasbara strategies of lying and propagandizing some new claim. I mean, they're pretty open. They're even more open about their genocidal policies than they were prior to this, which is obviously concerning, right? We see with the targeting of journalists and stuff. They just openly say, yeah, we killed the journalists. And before, previously it would be like, oh, it's a misfire. No, we didn't mean this. We would never intentionally attack a journalist. And same with this hospital that we're talking about, the Al Ahli Hospital in October 2023. I mean, after the airstrike on it, Israel obviously came out with a large series of, we would never attack a hospital. And if kind of following us, I'm sure you would know, like, I mean, so many Israel supporters, and regardless of the circumstances around exactly that strike, so many supporters of the Israeli military were going about saying that Israel would never attack a hospital. Israel's so principled. Israel fully respects international law. They never would intentionally attack a healthcare facility, and now has proceeded to attack almost every single hospital in Gaza multiple times over. Regardless of the circumstances of initial strike, I mean, Israel's strategy in the last 2 years has been the deliberate destruction. So to the point of discs, I mean, it can just come down to the soldier on a given moment if they want to allow anything in.
I mean, sterile fluid to cleanse wounds with, and dressings, clean dressings. These are things that could come in massive quantities. They're relatively inexpensive, I'm sure.
Yeah. And, you know, another issue that, and I mean, we highlight this briefly in the comment, is unfortunately, the way the system operates right now is there's not that much coordination between the different medical NGOs. And so obviously the WHO does attempt to kind of coordinate these different medical groups that are going into Gaza. And, you know, they go through the EMT rotation system that the WHO has set up. But the exact things that they're bringing on their person. So obviously now, before the May 2024 Israeli ground invasion of Rafah, there was, I would say, relatively easier to get some things into Gaza, especially because they were crossing through the Rafah border. So it was a bit easier to get things. So some people were bringing in like several carry-ons and check-in luggages worth of kind of medical supplies or food or whatnot, right? With an individual physician who's coming in. But that has dramatically decreased. And now it's really like, now they're very much checking down to like, it's just your personal items. That's not to say that they weren't doing this before, but from what I've heard from people, that has significantly increased since then. And so with that obviously comes another thing, is that there's little coordination, right? So, and I hear this frequently, where everyone who's trying to go is usually well-intentioned, right? So they're trying to bring in, okay, this is what I think is needed at, let's say, the Al-Aqsa Hospital. They have an assignment over there at the European Gaza Hospital in Khan Yunis. And they're trying to bring, okay, let me bring some drugs. Let me bring some, quite actually, sometimes chocolates. Sometimes they're bringing in like little note cards that people have written, like children. I've seen this. People have written that kind of note cards for children over there. Different things, because, right, it's not just about the drugs. It's not just about the healthcare. Or I guess you can even say a part of healthcare is also the psychosocial support that you provide to a population. And so these sorts of things that people are trying to bring in, it's poorly coordinated across NGOs. So two NGOs might be bringing in, or at least the people in these NGOs who are going to be bringing in some of the same stuff. So you'll never get an excess of anything in Gaza because of the blockade, but you may get more of something and less of something else, right? And a lot of people are unfortunately going to be, just because of the circumstances they're in, they're going to be prioritizing surgical supplies to perform surgeries, especially because surgeons are in high demand, just with Israel having killed and targeted so many of them in Gaza. And so things like infectious disease, unfortunately, take many times a back seat. And many of these are assessed in primary care clinics that are run by volunteers as well.
Is there any sense, Bilal, of how many Palestinians in Gaza have died from untreatable infectious diseases? Like 62,000 is the official number of dead from the bombs and the missiles that the United States has delivered, and Germany as well. But how many people have died from indirect causes? The estimates that have been published over the last couple of years in The Lancet puts it up to like 180,000, could be 200,000. Is there any idea how many people are dying in Gaza every day from infectious diseases that can't be treated?
You know, it's really hard to say, and I'll explain why. So you mentioned, for example, the Lancet correspondence that was published in the summer of 2024, which used kind of the indirect estimate of, I believe, four times the official death toll at the time to get to the number of 186,000. And now and as you allude to, the Palestinian Ministry of Health's numbers are largely focused on direct casualties from direct airstrikes and stuff. So they're not including the people who are dying from infectious diseases usually, and they're also usually not including people who are dying from chronic conditions who may have otherwise been treated, right? Like cancer, and I mean, because we know, for example, the oncology wards at so many different hospitals have been destroyed, and one of the oncology hospitals was actually just blown up. And Israel published a video kind of displaying blowing it up after converting it into a military base. I think it was the Turkish Friendship Hospital that they did this to, if I'm not mistaken. And so the death toll, and Hopkins has also, some researchers at, I think, the Bloomberg School of Public Health, John Hopkins, have also been publishing estimates, especially they started in 2024, and you kind of see the numbers that they put out there in different scenarios of, like, if there's a ceasefire, if there's these sort of conditions, how much aid is allowed in. And there have been other estimates in other media and stuff. And I believe Zina Jamaluddin published in The Lancet as well an estimate of actually even the number that we're talking about of direct deaths. They estimated direct traumatic injury was underestimated by, I believe, it is 41%. I think that's the number that they calculated. So if we just even extrapolate that to this number, it would be higher. But even the ways to collect the death toll. So I've been kind of looking at this issue with other epidemiologists and other medical students and physicians in Gaza. The way that they're calculating the death toll is really the opposite of what a lot of ministries of health were doing in COVID. So really, they're really trying hard to make sure that they have verification, they have witnesses in many cases, that they have, again, many times witnesses have been killed. Many times bodies have been incinerated to the point that there is no identification. So we don't even know the direct deaths. I mean, it's so hard to kind of calculate and get the sort of numbers that you would need for other infectious disease-related deaths.
But it's certainly much higher than 62,000.
I mean, the overall death toll, of course. I mean, of course, there's no question to that.
I talking about infectious disease, the story the other day about Nasser Hospital being flooded with sewage, right? Israel has destroyed Gaza's sewage system. It's wicked, right? They've destroyed the food production system, the agricultural fields, the greenhouses, the bakeries, the flour mills, so Palestinians can't feed themselves. And they've destroyed the hospitals, most of them. They've destroyed the sewage system. And so Nasser Hospital flooded in with fecal pollution.
Yeah, I saw those videos. We were getting the messages just a few days ago. from people who were stationed there. And unfortunately, a lot of the people who were stationed there were people who were previously displaced from the European Gaza hospital in the